Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we tackle complex topics and distill them into essential knowledge, helping you become truly well-informed. Today, we're plunging into a situation with incredibly high stakes. Imagine being a first-year doctor, fresh out of medical school, suddenly facing a rare, time-sensitive emergency in the operating room. Someone's life is literally hanging in the balance, and it's a scenario you've barely, if ever, encountered. How on earth do you prepare for that kind of pressure, those critical decisions, without risking a single actual patient?
It's a profound challenge, isn't it?
Oh.
Because it's far more than just mastering technical skills. It demands rapid critical thinking, seamless teamwork, and the ability to manage intense stress, all while making life or death decisions. That initial exposure in a real OR is incredibly high risk.
That's the very specific high-pressure world we're exploring today. How first-year anesthesiology residents, often called CA1s, are prepared for these crucial moments. Our deep dive today unpacks fascinating research on a specialized training approach known as a simulation boot camp, or SBC. And we'll connect it to two powerful psychological concepts, self-efficacy, which is about belief in one's own abilities, and cognitive load, which describes how our brains process information. We'll see how this intensive simulation doesn't just build skills, but fundamentally transforms how these new doctors perceive their own capabilities under pressure. So let's unpack how they bridge this critical gap.
Well, the learning curve for these CA1s is exceptionally steep. They need to rapidly acquire a complex array of technical, cognitive, and behavioral skills. However, practicing those initial steps in a real operating room is...
Well, it's severely limited. It truly is. Patient safety is always paramount. Naturally. But then you also have the intense pressure for efficiency, strict duty hour rules, and a host of other clinical demands. It's simply too risky to have someone attempting new procedures for the very first time on a live patient.
Precisely. And this is where simulation education becomes indispensable.
Mm-hmm.
It effectively shifts that potentially dangerous early phase of the learning curve away from actual patients. The benefits are quite broad. Residents acquire essential knowledge, they report high satisfaction with the process, and it allows for deliberate, risk-free practice.
That makes perfect sense for mastering routine procedures. But what about those truly rare high-stakes emergencies? The events doctors might encounter only a handful of times in their entire career, but absolutely have to get right.
Yeah, simulation is critical for those exact scenarios. Augments and standardizes their exposure to these emergencies, those rare but critical events that don't occur predictably in real life, and require immediate precise diagnosis and treatment to prevent patient harm. Research shows it significantly improves their knowledge, their skill, how quickly they complete tasks, and even their behavioral responses when they're under immense pressure.
Right.
What's striking is that residents themselves overwhelmingly agree it's essential and should be a required part of their training.
Okay, let's get specific then and look at a particularly well-regarded program, the Johns Hopkins Simulation Boot Camp, or SBC. This is a 5-day, high-fidelity experience initiated back in 2006 for their CA1s. It typically takes place during the third week of their orientation, once they've gained some basic familiarity with the perioperative environment.
And the level of realism they achieve is quite remarkable. The simulated ORs are meticulously outfitted with surgical and anesthesia equipment that mirrors actual patient operating rooms. They utilize advanced adult patient simulators, you know, high-tech mannequins that have full physiological function. They breathe, have pulses, and their vital signs are monitored realistically on standard OR equipment. They even incorporate something called moulage.
Moulage. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Sure. It's the application of mock injuries, like bruises or wounds, directly onto the mannequin. It's done to significantly enhance the visual realism, essentially tricking the brain into believing it's witnessing a real patient in distress.
Wow. So it's not just about the technical hardware. It sounds like they put a great deal of effort into recreating the human element as well to make it truly immersive. How do they manage that?
You're absolutely right. The human element is crucial. The teaching team itself is composed of experienced, board-certified anesthesiologists, nurses, scrub techs, and simulation specialists. And here's a truly ingenious detail. There's a concealed control booth, often behind a one-way mirror, where an operator manipulates the mannequin's physiological responses in real time based on the resident's actions.
Okay, real-time adjustments.
Exactly. And crucially, this operator also communicates with what they call embedded actors.
Embedded actors.
Yes, these are other anesthesiologists playing roles like a circulating nurse, a scrub tech, or even a surgeon. This creates that authentic interactive team dynamic you find in a real OR.
A whole choreographed experience happening in real time, it sounds incredibly complex to manage.
It is, but it's about providing a comprehensive, realistic challenge.
I'm curious, how far do they push that realism? Do they incorporate, like, the background noise you'd expect in an OR, adding to the mental workload?
They absolutely do. They layer in an authentic soundscape. Ambient or R noise, the constant beeping of machines, snatches of conversation, maybe a surgeon's requests. This isn't just for realism. It's intentionally designed to increase the mental and task load on the residents, just as it would be in a real operating room.
Okay, that makes sense.
And what's paramount and reinforced up front is that this SBC is purely educational. It's not evaluative. Performance is confidential, which fosters a psychologically safe space. This safety is essential for genuine learning, allowing participants to take risks, experiment, and make mistakes without fear of judgment.
That psychological safety sounds incredibly important for learning. Okay, so walk us through a typical day for a resident in this boot camp.
Sure. Each resident dedicates about an hour daily to the SBC. During that hour, they participate in two individual OR scenarios. Immediately following each scenario, there's a personalized 15-minute one-on-one debriefing session with a faculty member. While the scenarios are scripted in terms of their overall plot, the mannequin's responses are dynamic. The operator continually adjusts the physiological urgency based on the resident's actions, making it a truly adaptive learning experience.
That adaptive, personalized experience leads us perfectly into our first core concept, self-efficacy, or SE. This isn't just about having a basic competence and a skill. Self-efficacy is the belief you hold in your own ability to successfully execute a skill or behavior to achieve a desired outcome, especially when you're under pressure. Why is this inner belief, this confidence, so critical for new doctors?
It's foundational because high self-efficacy is directly linked to greater perseverance, increased effort, and enhanced resilience when challenges arise. It also means less self-doubt and anxiety in high-stakes situations. Conversely, low self-efficacy can hinder performance even when someone technically possesses the skills, simply because the pressure becomes overwhelming.
Right, the belief matters.
Exactly. And the good news is that self-efficacy can be significantly improved through targeted training.
And the SBC clearly has a profound impact here. The data from over a decade involving more than 250 participants is quite compelling. It showed the SBC significantly boosted self-efficacy across all 25 essential anesthesia skills measured. Take skills like rapid sequence induction, which is quickly securing an airway, or treating bronchospasm. These started with the lowest pre-SBC self-efficacy scores, yet they saw the most dramatic improvements.
Huge jumps.
Yeah, huge. Overall, the total self-efficacy scores increased by 38 points out of a possible 250, representing a truly significant shift in belief.
That truly is a substantial increase. And some of the demographic insights from this research are particularly fascinating, even a bit unexpected.
Oh, what insights stood out to the researchers?
Well, here's where it gets really interesting. Consider this. Participants with prior video gaming experience.
Video gaming? Seriously? In medical training?
Yes. They actually started with significantly higher baseline self-efficacy across all three key skill areas. Technical skills, diagnosis, and management.
That's quite an unexpected connection. So hours spent on a consular PC might actually contribute to becoming a more confident anesthesiologist. That's truly intriguing.
It might sound counterintuitive at first, but the researchers propose that the inherent aspects of gaming, you know, the constant practice and drilling, the acceptance of failure as a learning opportunity, the ability to reset in a consequence-free environment, cultivate a kind of resilience and problem-solving mindset fundamental to self-efficacy.
Okay. I can see that.
Plus, gaming can develop dexterity, spatial skills, attention allocation, and visual processing, all of which translate into better situational awareness and vigilance within a simulation. It's a different form of deliberate practice.
When you frame it that way, it makes a surprising amount of sense. What about gender differences? That's often a nuanced topic in professional training.
The study found something quite important here. While women, on average, started with significantly lower baseline self-efficacy scores than men, particularly in technical skills.
Which is unfortunately not uncommon to hear.
Right. But the SBC actually enhanced self-efficacy in women to a greater degree than it did in men.
So it helped actively close that initial gap. That's a significant outcome.
It really is. It suggests that the individualized nature of this simulation training might help counteract perceived gender-based biases or discrimination, making this style of learning particularly empowering for women entering the field.
That's fantastic. And what about residents who weren't straight out of medical school, perhaps those who had completed another residency previously?
Yes, those residents, many of whom had experience in high-pressure environments like pediatric intensive care units, which demand teamwork under pressure, they showed higher baseline self-efficacy, specifically in diagnosis and management skill areas.
Which makes perfect sense, given their prior medical training.
Exactly. It aligns perfectly with their prior experience and the demands of those previous roles.
So bringing all these threads together, what's the ultimate implication for medical education? It sounds like it's about far more than just increasing a score. So what does this all mean?
Absolutely. When this increased self-efficacy, this crucial belief, is combined with objective skill assessments by experienced faculty, it becomes a powerful indicator that a resident is truly ready for more independence and autonomy in a real operating room. It's about building both the actual skills and the crucial belief in their ability to apply those skills effectively when it truly counts, all nurtured within a safe, controlled practice environment.
That insight makes perfect sense. And it leads us seamlessly into our second core concept, cognitive load theory. This is fundamentally about how our brains learn and the inherent limitations of our working memory, correct?
Precisely. Cognitive load theory explains that our working memory, often compared to a computer's RAM, the part of our brain that actively processes new information, has very limited capacity. If this limit is exceeded, if too much information is thrown at it too quickly, learning is impaired. Things don't stick, and effective processing kind of grinds to a halt.
And I recall there are distinct types of mental load involved.
Yes. Generally, three key types are discussed. First, there's intrinsic load. This is the inherent difficulty of the material itself, like the complexity of a surgical procedure. It's also influenced by the learner's existing knowledge. Think of it as the basic task difficulty.
The core challenge of the material itself.
That's right. Second, we have extraneous load. Now, this is what you might call the bad kind of load.
The bad kind.
Yeah. It's imposed by elements external to the core learning task, such as confusing instructions, a poorly designed learning environment, or irrelevant distractions. The primary goal in good instructional design is always to minimize this extraneous load.
Get rid of anything that's just unnecessary friction to the learning process. Makes sense.
Precisely. And third, there's germane load. This is the good load.
The good load.
Right. It represents the mental effort directly involved in the learning process itself, deeply processing information, integrating it with existing knowledge, and building robust mental models or schemas. This is the effortful work that facilitates the transfer of knowledge from working memory into long-term memory. It's the load we actively want to promote for deep, lasting learning.
Okay, so intrinsic is the task difficulty, extraneous is the unhelpful distraction, and germane is the actual productive learning effort.
Mm-hmm.
How did the SBC design their simulations to effectively manage these different loads, particularly with elements like that ambient RR noise we discussed earlier?
That soundscape is a perfect illustration. They intentionally included those authentic sounds, the beeps, conversations, requests, not just for realism, but explicitly to increase the task load. What's fascinating here is how the residents perceived these sounds. They often categorize them as part of the intrinsic difficulty of the scenario, not as extraneous noise.
Huh. So they didn't just find it distracting or annoying background noise. They saw it as part of the job.
It appears so. This suggests they perceived skills like multitasking, prioritizing information, and communicating amidst that realistic noise as core competencies they needed to master for real-world practice. So those sounds became an essential part of the challenge, contributing to intrinsic load rather than just unhelpful extraneous load. That's a subtle yet incredibly important distinction in instructional design.
That certainly makes a lot of sense. And thinking about managing load, the scenarios themselves were carefully designed with escalating complexity rather than just throwing residents into the deep end immediately. Like you mentioned, an airway management scenario might begin with a relatively simple issue, perhaps a minor adjustment.
Right.
It would then build to a more challenging problem, like a difficult tube replacement, eventually culminating in a complex situation, such as bronchospasm, requiring differential diagnosis and multiple interventions. Each step builds on the last, ideally increasing germane load without causing cognitive overload.
Exactly. It sounds incredibly well-structured.
Yeah.
But you mentioned something earlier about what's considered the absolute most critical piece of this entire simulation learning puzzle.
Hmm.
What did the research highlight there?
You're absolutely right. What emerges most strongly from the research on this program, and indeed on simulation education broadly, is the paramount importance of the debriefing. Those 15-minute private one-on-one discussions with a faculty anesthesiologist immediately following the simulation are consistently cited as the most important aspect of the entire process.
Wow. The most important. That's a remarkably strong statement.
Yeah.
So it's not just the high-pressure scenario itself, but the focused conversation afterwards where the real learning is cemented. That feels almost counterintuitive, as we often emphasize the doing.
It does feel a bit counterintuitive, doesn't it? Yet a later study specifically analyzing cognitive load within this very SBC program found something remarkable. Participants reported a significant increase in germane load, that good learning focus load, after the debriefing session compared to before it.
Ah, okay. So the deeper mental work of consolidating the learning happens during that period of reflection and discussion. That's where the truly deep processing occurs.
Precisely. This strongly suggests that the debriefing process involving self-reflection, receiving targeted feedback from an expert, and talking through decisions and actions is where the effortful processing necessary for transferring information to long-term memory truly kicks into high gear. This is where deep learning solidifies. It's like you might attempt something new, perhaps stumble a bit, but it's only when you pause, reflect on why you stumbled, and get some expert guidance that you truly figure it out for next time.
So that implies that to accurately measure the cognitive load associated with learning, you really need to measure it after the entire experience, including that critical debriefing phase.
That's exactly what the research suggests. Measuring it only mid-simulation might miss this crucial phase of cognitive processing. And it's worth noting, the researchers explicitly chose not to use video playback during their debriefings.
Oh, interesting. Why not?
Well, other studies have indicated that video review can sometimes be detrimental, potentially increasing extraneous load or making participants defensive. Instead, their focus was on conversational debriefing to facilitate self-assessment and provide direct feedback on clinical management and crucial crisis resource management skills like leadership, communication, and teamwork.
That's a powerful takeaway about the design of effective learning, especially the critical role of structured reflection. And I know these cognitive load findings weren't just academic. They actually led to concrete changes in the SBC curriculum itself.
Right.
Yes.
And that's a fantastic real-world example of research directly improving training. They had a complex scenario involving managing a cardiac arrest during surgery. Initially, there were two versions, one where the resident was the first responder present at the start of the crisis, and another where they entered as a second responder, stepping into a chaotic situation already in progress without a pre-brief.
Okay, I can see how that second one would be tough.
Exactly. The data showed that these second responders experienced significantly higher extraneous load, likely from the chaos and confusion of entering mid-crisis.
Yeah, disorientation.
Right. And subsequently, lower germane load, meaning less effective learning, compared to the first responders who saw the event unfold from the beginning.
So throwing them into the chaos midstream was actually less effective for deep learning. It overloaded them in the wrong way.
Exactly. The disorientation and stress of entering mid-crisis seem to hinder the deep processing, the germane load. So based directly on these cognitive load findings, they removed the second responder version of that scenario from the curriculum. Now, all participants experienced the cardiac arrest scenario from its inception, ensuring everyone gets the optimal learning experience by maximizing beneficial germane load and minimizing unhelpful extraneous load.
That's data-driven curriculum evolution right there. Using the science of learning to make the training better.
Precisely. And so you've just taken a deep dive with us into how high-fidelity simulation training is truly changing the game in medical education. We've seen how meticulously designed programs like the Johns Hopkins Anesthesia Simulation Bootcamp can dramatically boost a resident's self-efficacy, that crucial belief in their own ability to perform under extreme stress.
And by understanding cognitive load, intrinsic, extraneous, and especially that vital germane load, and by recognizing the incredible power of structured, reflective debriefing, educators can fine-tune training for genuine, lasting learning, not just mere exposure to scenarios.
And you know, this isn't just about doctors learning complex procedures. Think about the high stakes, maybe complex environments in your own life, perhaps starting a challenging new job, tackling a difficult project, or even mastering a personal skill you've been working on.
Yeah. How might understanding your own self-efficacy, that belief in your capabilities, and considering your own cognitive load, how your brain handles new information, how might that change the way you approach learning, practice, or even just manage stress in those situations?
And building on that, what role could creating a safe space for yourself, you know, a non-judgmental environment where you can practice, perhaps stumble, and then get honest, constructive feedback, play in your journey towards mastering something difficult. What could you truly achieve if you deliberately built that kind of learning environment for yourself? Some interesting things to think about.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. We hope you gained some surprising insights and valuable tools for your own learning journey.
We look forward to diving in with you again next time on The Deep Dive.